This is the conclusion of our study on Christian evidences tonight, Lord willing, and we appreciate everybody being here and listening well and having lots of good comments along the way, and I certainly hope, and I know Brother Jan does as well, that what we've been able to present to you over these 5 months or so has been helpful, and we'd hope that will be beneficial for all of us, but especially for our younger people, that they would have their faith strengthened from seeing the evidences that we have, that we do have an eternally powerful Creator, our God in heaven. And the evidence of His existence is great, and that's what we've been looking at for all of this time. How do we know that? How do we know that we have a Creator? What is the evidence for everyone, so that no one has an excuse to not seek God and glorify Him as God? His creation reveals that. God has revealed Himself through the creation. So we've studied lots about that. And at the same time, we've also looked at how God's evidence refutes the gainsayers, those who do not believe in Him and try to give an explanation for the existence of the creation and all that there is, ourselves included, and what is presented and taught by those in this world that don't accept the evidence that proves we have an eternally powerful Creator, God. We've looked at how God's evidence refutes them and how they do not have evidence on their side for, and that goes to the entire idea that all that we have that exists in this material universe came to be without a Creator. There was no Big Bang that then led to all of these, all that we have in the heavens, including this earth, and then eventually life and mankind, all of that. There is no natural way to explain that without there being a God. And so when I say natural, meaning just by nature, by natural means, not by special creation by God. We know that there was a creation of all the things that exist. We're part of it. So that's what we've been looking at for these various months. Tonight in our finale, we want to approach things a little bit differently to finish off. And that is everything that we've looked at up to now, really, it's been based in what we do see or what we can know. And on the grand scale, I mean, when we look at the universe and all that is in it, we see from that for certain that there's someone, God, who made all of it. And then even when we've delved into the complexity of what God has made and the irreducible complexity of the things that He has made, that shows that it could not have happened without Him making it. That has involved our looking at a lot of great details of things that exist, whether it's in nature itself or several of the presentations that I gave focused on the human body and its functions and how God has designed that. But with all of that, it's focused on things that we do know, that we've learned about. And for certain, up to our present day, in recent decades, in the time since Charles Darwin lived, when he wrote his book, going back to the 1850s and 60s when he was writing his books, I mean, here we are 160, almost 170 years after that, and how much have we learned, and how much advancement has there been in knowledge of the material universe over that period of time. I mean, it's vast. What is the name for the age that we live in that is used so often? We live in the what age? Well, modern, but there's a particular term. I know this is a reason my mind. What?
Christian age.
Well, yes. The term, we live in the information age is something that we hear a lot. Brother Glenn, you're right. We do live in the Christian age. That's as God describes it. But as far as how it's labeled here in modern times, we will often see that term, the information age that we live in. Well, do we have more information at our fingertips, literally, than really anybody ever has? It's astounding when we think about it. A lot of the technological development in my lifetime. I remember, I'm old enough to barely remember the last Apollo missions men walked on the moon. I barely remember that, but I do. I remember my dad taking us out on the roof of the house of their cross town that I grew up in, and we could see one of the Apollo rockets up in the sky. I don't remember which one it is. My brothers could tell you. But I remember seeing that as a very little guy. But just in my lifetime, in the lifetime of most of the ones in here, or many, anyway, man walked on the moon. I mean, we've sent men to the moon. We've sent spacecraft to explore, observe, and measure things of all the planets in our solar system. We have satellites orbiting the Earth, telescopes orbiting that are powerful and can observe and calculate things in the universe so that we can know a lot. But from all that information we have and all the observations that we've made, all the scientific discovery, scientific knowledge, and now we're talking about true science, not how it's been warped into false things by so many as it has, and we've gone through that. But what we have learned, I mean, it's vast. And everything that we've looked at up to this point has really been a reflection of all these things that we've learned, particularly in recent times. But that might give a false impression. We have all this information, and when people talk about scientists, we think about, well, I mean, it gives the impression to a lot of people like we really know everything. But how much do we really know? Do we know what we don't know? That's another way of asking it. There is an enormous amount that we don't know and can't explain. So we don't want to have the false idea that we are so intelligent and so knowledgeable that we really have the answers to most questions about the material universe. We've learned a lot, but there's so many things that we don't know. And tonight we want to really focus on the evidence of the wisdom of God. We can go back to Proverbs chapter 8, and I have verses 1 and 12 leading off there because it establishes wisdom as the speaker here so that we can, by the time we get down to verse 22, we can know who is in the role of the speaker in Proverbs 8. But in verse 1 it begins, "Doth not wisdom cry and understanding put forth her voice? I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions." All right, then skipping down to verse 22, wisdom is still speaking and says, "The Lord possessed me in the beginning of his way before his works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning, or ever the earth was. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills was I brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth, nor the fields, nor the highest part of the dust of the world. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he set a compass upon the face of the depth, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he gave to the sea his decree that the water should not pass his commandment, when he appointed the foundations of the earth, then I was by him as one brought up with him, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in the habitable part of his earth, and my delights were with the sons of men. Now therefore hearken unto me, O ye children, for blessed are they that keep my ways, hear instruction, and be wise, and refuse it not. Blessed is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoso findeth me findeth life, and shall obtain favor of the Lord. But he that sinneth against me wrongeth his own soul. All they that hate me love death. Well, that's a chapter that begins with wisdom speaking, and it concludes with those verses that show us the importance of our seeking the wisdom of God. But what is one of the main points in Proverbs chapter 8 that illustrates the great wisdom that God possesses? And it's an eternal wisdom, as he teaches there. But how much of those verses talk about the wisdom that God displayed in his creation of this material universe that we live in? So that we can observe that what we observe from the creation displays that wisdom. There's a reason there's a term intelligent design. And we've seen that through all of what we've studied in this course. But how much wisdom is on display by God's creation? I mean, it's vast for us to contemplate, which we need to, because then we need to seek the God who has that wisdom and to possess that wisdom, to learn and obtain that wisdom as he offers it. So we want to look at the microscopic universe this evening. We've looked at things on the larger scale. We've looked at a lot of things down to the atomic level. And here's some of the things. There's some slides here that I presented some weeks ago when we were looking into genetics and kind of building ourselves up to understanding what DNA is, the DNA molecule. Well, there's these elementary or fundamental particles of physics, quarks and leptons, which they form, combine to form what's called hadrons, that include protons and neutrons. So those are the basic particles that make up, those are subatomic particles, smaller than an atom, that then make up the parts of the atom, the protons, neutrons, and electrons. And so we went to that point. That was as small as we got. So we got down to that level and then build up from there to molecules and learning about DNA and those kinds of things. So that's just a little bit of a refresher of some things we've already seen here. And there's the structure of an atom. So I think we learned that in school. And then, of course, chemical elements, of which there are 118, and those are formed from the different compositions that an atom can have. And so there are 118 different kinds that are called elements. There's the periodic table of the elements that we've all seen before, especially my mother, that spent a career teaching that. There we go. I mean, those are atoms and elements, compounds and things of which everything is made. But that was as small as we got, and then we kind of got bigger from there. And occasionally we've been on the molecular level or the biochemical level in some of the things we've presented. This is a guy named Max Planck. He had a lot of other names as well. It wasn't just Max. It was Max with several other names. But that's the shortest form of the name of Max Planck, who's the founding father of quantum theory. So we get into some quantum physics here. I'm not a physicist. I had to take physics courses and learn a good bit of physics as part of what I had to learn in my studies. preparing for the study of medicine, but I don't have a degree in physics. I'm not a physicist, and I never studied in detail quantum physics, but there are physicists that spend their career in this field. But quantum theory, it's a fundamental theory of physics that describes the behavior of matter and energy at the atomic and the subatomic levels. So it's not concerned with the bigger picture, and it's concerned with the very, very small. And here's the point of it, though, and again, I'm not a physicist. I don't know all this stuff. I haven't memorized all these things, and we're not expecting any of us to, but we're just taking a glimpse at the small. Because when we get what we have learned from the very small as we have gotten to learn about, the stranger things get. And the more things, kind of, as far as what we know of as laws of physics and the way things work, when we get down to a very small level, all that stuff starts to break down and doesn't really work anymore and it doesn't explain things. And then all of a sudden, all these huge question marks come up, and things of like, well, how does this work at this level, and how do we explain this? And there's so much there that we don't know. God made all the big things, this entire universe, but He made all those big things from very little things. And who knows everything right down to the smallest parts, and how much of that is still a mystery to man? A lot. So this is the point of this, is to make us wallow in our ignorance for a while, for us to contemplate how little we know about all of it that God has made. We know a lot of things, but we don't know so much. And this will, I think we will get to see some of that with what we're looking at here. This is one of them here. Quantum entanglement. All right, this is where you get two particles, and that those term entangled, somehow they're linked together. When they're not measured, each particle may exist in multiple states at the same time, apparently. But when a particle is measured, then it's in what's called a superposition whatever particle it is entangled with is going to then instantaneously enter a corresponding state to that. So like this this particle over here, if you measured it and it was rotating in a clockwise fashion, immediately this one over here would be in a counterclockwise rotation. And it's not, they don't even have to be close together. They can be separated by light years. And it's instant. So this is really fascinating because the question is this information that's somehow traveling faster than the speed of light? How is this? How do you explain this quantum entanglement where you've got particles that seem to be linked together and instantaneously just measuring one will cause you to be able to measure the other one right at that same time, doing something related to it. It can't be explained by science. There's a big question mark about it. I don't know if you've ever heard of Schrodinger's cat. This is actually Hannah's cat, and she named it Schrodinger. because of this. So that's our little Schrodinger at home. He's a really sweet cat. But this is based in a guy named Erwin Schrodinger, who in 1935, just going back to, he was coming up with a thought experiment based on this, because, I mean, the weird thing is, when you're not measuring it, one of these things could be anything at the same time, evidently. But it's when you observe it, measure it, then you've got something that then instantly makes the other thing do whatever corresponds to that. steel chamber, but somehow it's entangled with this radioactive atom, that if you observe it, either that radioactive atom is, if you've got like the broken bottle and it releases the radiation and kills the cat, or if you observe it and it's not broken and then the cat's alive, that illustrates the entanglement. Broken flask, radioactive, dead cat. Not broken, cat's not radiated, cat's alive. But according to the according to quantum entanglement, these particles, before you observe it and measure it, they're kind of everything at once. So Erwin Schrödinger was saying, can the cat be both dead and alive until you observe it? You know, that doesn't make sense. Well, see, this is where we're seeing quantum physics. It can't work on the level where we observe things, because you can't have a cat that's alive and dead at the same time. We know that, and that was his point. But yet, when we get down to the small level and you've got quantum entanglement of particles, I mean, that's basically what's happening. And then you scratch your head, well, how can it be? Well, we can't explain it. It makes no sense. And it doesn't translate to the larger things as that thought experiment, as it demonstrates. Okay, there's this double hole or double slit experiment. So if you pass an electron through this, through the holes or slits, and then you got a screen on the other side, can you see spots where those electrons hit? Or does it make, does it reflect like particles, or does it produce waves like photons of light would? Well, the answer is yes and yes. And the weird thing is, it's that way. What we observe changes what it does somehow. So here's where we got a video to watch. That shows the experiment. But observation influences what is observed. Now that doesn't make sense, does it? That just merely by watching something, that can change what's going on that you're watching just by passively observing it? That doesn't really compute, does it? Well, but it does at the quantum physics level. So, in the double slit or double hole experiment, when particles are observed, they behave like particles. But when they're not observed, they behave like waves. I mean, you want to explain that? Nobody can. All right, let's see. This is where we want to...
It seems like the behavior of quantum mechanical stuff is different when we're looking at it than when we're not looking at it.
This profound conclusion comes from performing the double hole experiment. Scientists first conducted this experiment a century ago, firing photons of light through a metal plate with two slits. The light that went through the holes hit a screen behind the plate.
I'm going to demonstrate the results of this amazing experiment with a bunch of baseballs and a barrier that we've set up, which has two holes in it. Now, normally in the everyday world, if I throw baseballs through one hole or the other, they'll form a predictable pattern on a screen that we've set up behind home plate. They'll be in one place or the other. Now, let's make that pattern with a whole bunch of baseballs. I'm going to use this pitching machine. Here's the first one. Let's see what happens. Now you see, the balls landed on the screen in two bunches, pretty much along a direct line from each of the two holes. That's natural. That's what we expect. But when we descend into the microscopic universe and use electrons, which are 10 trillion times smaller than baseballs, we get a very different, odd result when we perform this experiment. A pattern that you would expect if these were waves going through both poles at the same time and interfering with themselves. Well, we usually think of electrons as being particles. So how can they exhibit wave-like properties?
These test results were confounding. The electron was a particle before it was fired at the screen, yet it formed a pattern on the screen as if this single electron had gone through both holes at the same time. Does a microscopic particle spontaneously clone itself in midair? After years of study, scientists still don't know exactly what's happening.
Probably the most magical thing is that in quantum physics, an object can be in more than one place at the same time.
It actually can sense both slits and actually go through and quantum mechanically feel the structure of both slits in the experiment.
Most physicists agree that the math is quite solid and leads to solutions that are undeniable and can be confirmed with experimental measurements. But exactly what is happening and how is a matter of debate.
To try to grasp this amazing experimental result, scientists decided to observe how individual electrons behaved when they went through the double slit. How exactly could a particle go through both holes at the same time?
Scientists got a front row seat to observe the strange behavior of these electrons or other subatomic particles or even photons of light. Doesn't really matter as long as they're small. They didn't just look at where they landed on the screen back there. They also watched the behavior of the particles as they went through the holes. And then they saw something amazing. When scientists were watching the holes, the electrons behaved like particles, forming the baseball-like pattern on the screen back there. But when the scientists weren't watching, then the electrons behaved like waves. They formed a pattern that looked like the interference pattern produced by waves on a screen. That's really strange. What you see depends on whether you're watching or not. If you're watching, you see the particle-like behavior, like baseballs. If you're not watching, you see a wave-like behavior, but not both at the same time.
This was nothing less than astounding. Observation seems to change the nature of subatomic particles.
Mysteriously, when we're not looking, things are waves. When we are looking, they look like particles. So even an electron, which seems to us like a particle, has wave-like properties when we're not looking at it.
The fact that when we don't look, the electron appears to go through both holes, but when we do look, we always see it go through one hole or the other, is what we call the quantum enigma.
How could our decision about whether to observe something change how that something acts? There is a technical explanation.
To make an observation, you somehow have to interact with the system. For example, you have to shine light on it, which then bounces off, and you observe the light. That's how we can tell that a baseball is here or there. We bounce light off of it. Well, for macroscopic particles, that doesn't disturb them very much. But for microscopic particles, the act of bouncing the light off of the particle changes where it is and how it's moving.
So in the microscopic universe, where photons of light are about the same size as subatomic particles, these photons have a big impact when they illuminate the particles so we can see them. But this doesn't answer the question, why doesn't the light simply change the direction of the subatomic particles? Why does observation actually change the nature of what is being observed?
The short answer is we don't know. This is the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics, the reason why quantum mechanics is difficult. Mysteriously, when we look at things, we see particles. But when we're not looking, things are waves.
This is something we scientists have argued passionately about now for almost 100 years, and there's still no consensus.
When they were first released a century ago, These test results were enough to unsettle the brightest mind in science.
Einstein said, I don't believe in quantum physics because I believe the moon is there even when I'm not looking at it. Einstein was, of course, referring to the implications of the theory that the moon really isn't anywhere until it's observed.
Anybody got an explanation for that? It's kind of interesting.
It seems like the behavior of quantum mechanical...
One more here. This is much shorter. But it gets even weirder, if you can imagine.
However, the double hole experiment's mind-boggling conclusions don't end there. In recent years, technology has allowed scientists to perform a fascinating variation of the test. Its results call into question our perception of time itself.
This is like a high-tech version of the double hole experiment. Electrons are being fired toward a barrier with two holes in it. But the scientists can delay their decision about whether to observe the electrons until after they've passed through the holes, but before they hit the screen. It's as though I'm on a baseball field, and there's a baseball being pitched toward the barrier with the holes in it. But my eyes are closed, so it goes through, and it behaves like a wave. But then, at the last second before it hits the screen, I open my eyes and decide to observe it.
At that moment, the electrons, in essence, become particles, and seemingly always were particles from the time they left the electron gun.
So it's as though they went back in time to before they went through the holes and decided to go through one or the other, not through both as they would have had they been behaving like waves. That's really crazy.
That's the enigma. That our choice of what experiment to do determines the prior state of the electron. Somehow or other, we've had an influence on it, which appears to travel backwards in time.
Well, who made those little things and made them behave in such ways that when the most brilliant men look at those things, it's called an enigma. There's no explanation for it. There are a lot of other things. When the gravitational forces in the universe are measured, there's not nearly enough observable matter to explain the amount of gravitational forces that exist. So that's led to a theory called dark matter, that there's some invisible matter which actually would be greater than the visible kind of matter that we know about. And then this so-called dark matter, which is theoretical, it would be invisible, would not interact with light or other electromagnetic radiation. It's something that is a total idea, nothing proven about it, but it's just because of the lack of being able to explain or understand the gravitational forces that are measurable in the universe that we can't account for with the matter that we can observe. So they come up with dark matter, but is there such a thing? Well, who knows? Of course, the Lord knows, but I mean, that's the point. There's just so much when we get to this level that can't be explained. There's another thing called string theory that's an attempt to come up with a mathematical model to describe all the fundamental interactions that exist in the universe. And so instead of having point-like particles, you would have these one-dimensional strings that can then vibrate in different modes and would correspond to a different particle with specific properties like mass or charge, these kinds of things. It would then have to exist in multiple dimensions, even beyond the three dimensions that we know of matter versus, and also time itself. I mean, it's just, again, it's just some theory that's been postulated because of how much we don't know and can't explain with what we do have. So all of this is just way of saying, trying to grapple with all that we don't know, because there's so much that we do not know. And this brings to a conclusion the last, Job has 42 chapters, but chapters 38 through 41, before the short 42nd chapter, we have four chapters of the book of Job where it's spent making this point. God was making this point to Job. And how did God spend four chapters contrasting this, not just for the man Job, but for all mankind? But how did God spend those four chapters showing how we are not like him, in the sense of we do not have, we can be like him in heart, of course, but as far as having his intelligence, having his wisdom to his extent, or, you know, we're not God. And how did he spend four chapters illustrating that point or proving that point? With questions that how did Job do on the, if it were actually a test, how would Job have scored on the test? Like a big zero. I mean, how would we score on the test? I mean, so God starts there in Job 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." How many scientists on this earth today could God speak to in that way? And then start firing off questions and then watch them just be in utter silence, unable to answer anything. Well, look at the questions he asked. Where was thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? And who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut up the sea with doors when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. As thou commanded the morning since the days, and caused the day spring to know his place, that it may take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it. It is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment. And from the wicked their light is withholden, and the high arm shall be broken. Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Are there springs in the sea? I mean, God is speaking about things that exist, but, and Brother Jan had some very interesting videos, because now there are submersibles that have been sent down to actually see where some of these exist. But how much of the springs of the sea are known even now? I mean, we can show that they're there. I mean, but God spoke about them being there at that point. But, I mean, just these questions, God is speaking of these things he's made, and we know so little about it. He says, have the gate, verse 17, have the gates of death been opened unto thee, or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? Hast thou perceived the breadth of the earth? Declare if thou knowest it all. Where is the way where light? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? We were getting a little look at that issue, weren't we? How do the brightest physicists, even Einstein, just said, fully on quantum mechanics, because he says, I know the moon is there. What can the brightest mind say about that? And how much is really understood about light and how it works and these other things that God has made. That thou shouldest take it to the bound thereof, and that thou shouldest know the paths to the house thereof. Knowest thou it because thou wast then born, or because the number of thy days is great? Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble against the day of battle and war. Now, one of the things, what do we know about snowflakes that we've learned? Each one is different. They've got six sides, but they're all, those crystals are all different. But how much do we not know about those things still? He says, verse 24, by what way is the light parted which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Who, and we're just looking a little bit about, does light part? It does. We still don't understand it. Who hath divided a water course for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? Do we have anything where we can predict where lightning's going to strike to warn people? I mean, we know about what man has always known. If there are dark clouds coming and it's the right time of year, you're supposed to not be outside where you can get hit by lightning. But, I mean, is there any prediction of where the lightning's going to strike? Why can't we do that? We're so smart, why can't we just know where the next lightning bolt's going to hit? We don't know. We don't have a clue. Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? Out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that abundance of waters may cover thee? Can we make it rain? I don't mean like artificial snow when you make a little snow machine or something, but can we cure droughts? No. Canst thou send lightning so that they may go and say unto thee, here we are? Who hath put wisdom in the inward parts, or who hath given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds in wisdom? Who can stay the bowels of heaven? When the dust groweth into hardness, and the clods cleave fast together, wilt thou hunt the prey for the lion, or fill the appetite of the young lions, when they couch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie in wait? Who provideth for the raven his food, and his young ones cry unto God? They wander for lack of meat. Well, that was just chapter 38. I mean, I've got the next several, all the way through 41, up there. And I would recommend reading that again. Just all those questions, and what does it show us?
It's showing us that God, his wisdom, his knowledge is so far apart from ours. He wants us to understand that, I believe, how far apart it is. How much probably God knows more than what he's revealing here that we will probably never understand as long as we're here.
He's revealed a portion to man, and he gives it out bit by bit. And yes, we've accumulated a lot of that he has enabled man to discover about this material universe. But how much is God still withholding of that?
I mean, if he didn't withhold, he could probably kill a person.
Yeah.
The population.
Yeah. And but we know a little bit. Certainly man knows enough to get very proud of what he knows. But we do need to consider, and that's why we wanted to finish on this note tonight, just how little we actually do know and how vast the wisdom of God is, that we can see from what he's made, both by what we can observe and recognize, but also with looking at all that God has made, and know there's a wisdom and an intelligence there that is far beyond anything that we can contemplate or ever match. And it shows who is God, and he is. So that's really the note we wanted to finish this on. And we can seek to know God, and he's willing to give us wisdom, and so we can know his ways and follow them, and that's the point of it all, Brother B. being as vast as he is and all of his power and wisdom and intelligence, but he cares for us. He cares for us and knows every hair on our head and makes it possible for us to know him through his son, for us to be able to understand his will and to be able to see his heart, to find out what we need to be like and then work with us to be that, which is the ultimate take-home point from all of this, is seeing who he is. And we do have a magnificent and wonderful creator that we need to seek, and who promises us that if we seek him diligently, we will find. But we need to seek him. Appreciate everybody's patience through this, and I know a lot of the material is really complicated, which is good for us to see that. That's again a big part of it. But we can always think about these things that God has made, and know that we do have an eternally powerful creator.